Hi, Alex.
Hey, Bob. How are you?
I'm doing well. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright of Blogging Heads TV. You're Alex Gibney, the famous and Academy Award-winning documentary filmmaker.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk about your most recent, in fact, brand new documentary about WikiLeaks and Julian Assange and Bradley Manning called We Steal Secrets. And we're also going to talk about its connection to the most recent round of leaks, which feature a, in some ways, Bradley Manning-like figure, in some ways very different, Edward Snowden. First, let me say congratulations. I watched the film over the weekend, downloaded it from via iTunes, and for a modest fee, got to watch it. Very engrossing. You took a complicated story and made it really illuminating, coherent. And I was very impressed.
Thank you. Yeah, that was, it took a lot of work. We were at this a long time, but
you can tell that it was a sprawling research effort, but it winds up being a very, very, very tidy story. One thing I want to talk about before we in the end is that you've taken some heat from the left, where you're not accustomed to taking heat from.
That's right.
On your depiction of Julian Assange. And in a way that I think is itself very, very much connected to what's going on now, because now people are arguing about this Edward Snowden figure and, you know, should we love him? Should we hate him? And there's a tendency to kind of conflate that with a question of the value of what he's done, you know?
Right.
That's very much what the controversy about your film is about, right?
That's right. I mean, and people should be able to embrace contradictions. The idea that you may not like a guy, and that doesn't mean what he's doing isn't right. So, I found it interesting that for some on the left, not all, but for some, you know, they need Julian Assange to be an unalloyed hero. He needs to be perfect in every way, shape, or form. And if you criticize him for any reason, then somehow you're betraying the cause. Well, I just don't see it that way. It seems to me that the original purpose of something like WikiLeaks was to try to tell the truth, not to airbrush the truth in order to make a more convenient political point. So, and I think, you know, in the case of Assange, it's not just prurience that led me down the road of talking about some of his failings. You know, it goes to the heart of his mission and how I think ultimately he ended up betraying it. So that, I think, is the point.
And betraying it in what way in particular?
Well, in a couple of ways. First of all, let's look at this Swedish episode, for example.
Involving the women who
that's right. The allegations of sexual misconduct in Sweden. I mean, when they initially arose, you know, I had already done a film called Client 9, The Rise and Fall of Elliot Spitzer. And when these sexual allegations arose, I kind of assumed that they might have been some kind of conspiracy, some sort of CIA put-up job, or there was something very fishy about them because of the timing. So I wasn't sure whether to treat them, and I also wasn't sure how to put them in the context of the story. But I ended up looking into them, you know, rather carefully. What was interesting to me about them was that they seemed to be actually purely a personal matter, and yet what happened along the way was that Julian Assange decided to take these allegations and intentionally make them part of the WikiLeaks story, as if to say, oh yeah, don't worry, this is part of the assault on me and freedom of speech. So suddenly he was putting his followers into the position of having to defend his alleged misconduct in Sweden in order to be on side, in effect. So that, to me, created a huge problem. In other words, conflating all sorts of personal issues with your larger transparency agenda in order to get more sympathy, in order to look like you're the subject of this huge international kind of conspiracy that's something right out of, Girl with a Dragon Tattoo. So that was number one. I think the other issue had to do with his rather sloppy behavior having to do with the handling of documents. And his kind of high-handed manner, you know, he's very arrogant, and he doesn't, you know, he's a guy whose website is intended to hold governments and corporations to account rightly. And I think that's its genius, because it can do so, you know, without being held to account in itself, i.e. it publishes on cyberspace outside of any national boundaries, and what is quite smart, but the idea that then he should not be able to be held to account, that it's impossible to even say that he makes mistakes, is very dangerous, because you can see him rolling down the same road that, say, the military does, which is never admit wrongdoing, you know, move forward and, you know, dissemble. He, after all, his nickname, as opposed to Edward Snowden, whose nickname is Verax, meaning truthful, Julian's nickname is Mendax, or used to be Mendax, which means nobly untruthful. And that tells us, I think, a lot about the guy.
I hadn't noticed that connection. Was Snowden's name chosen with that in mind? I mean, that's quite a parallel, or...
It is, and I suspect that it was, but I don't know for sure. I mean, I was kind of gobsmacked when I was just reading pieces about him today, mm-hmm. And noted that his nickname is Verax, which seems like a subtle swipe at Julian, but I don't know if that if it was just a coincidence. It doesn't seem like it was a coincidence, but yeah. We'll see.
I mean, there are lots of contrasts between the two cases, it seems to me. And one is the whole rationale for leaking, right? And I guess here we could compare Snowden either to Assange or to Bradley Manning, and maybe we should do both in turn. But, you know, how would you compare, you know, Snowden's philosophy of leaking and rationale for leaking to, say, Assange's, for starters?
Well, Assange's view was that the way to further leaking was to create an anonymous electronic Dropbox, some place where leakers could simply anonymously drop materials into a site, and they would be uploaded at the other end, and neither the leaker nor the publisher would know where the material came from. That was mm-hmm. what was the way it was supposed to be in theory. And then the other mechanism was that, you know, the website, the publishing part, would exist on the internet outside of national boundaries, so that you wouldn't be subject to the same kind of political pressures that, say, the New York Times might be subject to. Though, at the end of the day, WikiLeaks, much like the principles involved with Snowden in this case, did join forces with some mainstream media organizations, the New York Times, The Guardian, and Der Spiegel initially, and then others after that. But I think what Snowden has forcefully said, and actually said rather specifically, was that he elected to do this non-WikiLeaks style. He wanted contact with a journalist that he knew or could trust, mm-hmm. he knew and could trust, and that he didn't want to leak anonymously. Indeed, at the end of the day, wanted to let everybody know who he was, mm-hmm. Which is really interesting. And I think the other aspect of it was that Bradley Manning leaked a lot of documents. I think there was some selection process going on, certainly mm-hmm. with the video, but, you know, hundreds of thousands of documents. Snowden is saying he's only comfortable leaking the very few documents that he knows are not damaging in his view to or threatening to other people, and that he's actually seen and read himself.
Right. I mean, with Assange, and maybe to some extent with Bradley Manning, but certainly with Assange, I gather the philosophy, the idea of leaking had almost nothing to do with the content of the leaks in a certain sense, right? I mean, he had this whole theory of the virtue of transparency, which when I've looked into it is turns out to be more complicated than the standard, you know, sunlight is the best disinfectant kind of, you know, he had a whole theory about how you bring down bad regimes, including, you know, how transparency is just bad for all these regimes, that he didn't like, which is to say, you know, most of them, including the U.S. government. Whereas with Snowden, it was very much about a specific body of information that he thought should see the light, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think we have to start to draw distinctions here because Assange is not as much like Snowden as Manning is. I think Manning and Snowden are closer together. Assange is more like a publisher. He's saying, you know, send me your leaks. And actually, the New Yorker magazine, for example, has adopted a similar kind of mechanism for itself. The internet activist Aaron Swartz designed for them a kind of WikiLeaks-like Dropbox that they're now using for anonymous leaks. I think the trick, though, is that it's that whole relationship between the source and the publisher or the journalist that's at the heart of the matter. Julian, I think his belief was that it should be a mechanical process. I think the tragedy of the Bradley Manning case is that we learned that maybe it shouldn't have been, you know, because ultimately, it wasn't a failure of the machine that allowed Bradley Manning's identity to be revealed. It was a kind of human need to talk. And also, you know, obviously, the anonymous leaking platform creates other problems, too, which is how do you know the documents are authentic? Obviously, there are ways of checking. But, you know, I suspect in the future there'll be quite a lot of disinformation. And I think just by reading the accounts that the people involved with Snowden were concerned that this might be the case here, too.
Yeah, I think you're right that Snowden is more analogous to Manning than to Assange, although he is like Assange in that he's the guy who had this body of information and he was in contact with these major media, you know, about helping disclose it. But Manning is the original leaker and Snowden is, in his case, the original leaker. So let's compare their motivations. Now, from your film, I got the sense that Manning's motivation was, in a certain sense, diffuse. I mean, how well, you know, it seems to have had something to do with his frustration with his whole social environment in Iraq, and that in turn probably had something to do with his sexual identity. But it wasn't just that. I mean, that was linked up to something that I guess you could call ideological in a different sense, right? I mean, how would you compare the motivation and rationale of Manning on the one hand with Snowden on the other?
Well, I actually think that Manning's motivation to leak was political. I think that he saw a lot of things that he didn't like in documents that he was reviewing, and he had become increasingly politicized or radicalized. And I think maybe part of that process was the disaffection that he felt with the military as being gay in a time of don't ask, don't tell. And he was also going through his own crisis, wondering whether or not he should become a woman, in fact. So, but I think his motivation to leak was political, you know, it was motivated by the idea that there was a lot of that the government was telling a lot of lies, and I think people would profit. That is to say, everybody in the world would profit from seeing this stuff. On the other hand, I mean, the interesting thing about Manning was that he also was going through a personal crisis in the midst of all of this. That doesn't diminish Manning's political motivations, but I do think it makes him interesting for all of us as a human being. I mean, we've all got problems. We're all in the midst of this stuff. He's not a kind of perfect hero, as many would have us believe. But the other problem was that Manning, at the end of the day, revealed himself because he had a desperate need to talk to somebody. And after he had leaked all these documents, WikiLeaks really wasn't there for him to talk to. So he reached out on his own to a guy named Adrian Lamo, a gray hat hacker. And Lamo turned out to be, from Manning's perspective, exactly the wrong person to reach out to. He turned him in. But there was what's so interesting about the dialogue between Lamo and Manning is it's not just political dialogue. It's full of a lot of very sort of deep personal stuff And I think Manning also reached out to Lamo in part because Lamo was openly bisexual and was interested in WikiLeaks. He may have been some kind of agent. I don't really know. But I think that Manning reached out to him because he needed to talk to somebody.
Right. And my sense was that...
Do you have a different view of that from having seen
the film? No, I got that from your film. I mean, I saw a connection between Manning's personal issues and his personal predicament by virtue of being in the army with his sexual identity. I saw a connection between that and the political motivation, in the sense that I gathered that his personal issues contributed to his rage against the machine.
Yes,
but
that's true.
That's not to say that the rage was not warranted in its own right.
Right. I think that's correct. I think you see it exactly right.
And, you know, so too with Snowden, you know, Jeffrey Toobin, I don't know if you saw his little piece, Jeffrey Toobin in The New Yorker, saying, well, is Snowden a hero? Is he a whistleblower? No, he's a grandiose narcissist. And I'm thinking, well, those aren't really mutually exclusive, right?
I totally agree with that. They're not mutually exclusive at all. I mean, and so what if he's self-interested? So what if he's a narcissist? Does that, you know, most of our politicians are narcissists. Should we then discount all their laws? I don't think so.
Right.
I think, you know, yeah, and also Toobin's point always seems to be, oh, there were mechanisms that Snowden could have gone through, you know, which, you know, traditional whistleblower mechanisms, he could have gone to his superiors and so forth and so on. I don't think so. I don't think if he had gone to his superiors and said, gosh, I have a huge problem with the NSA and how the NSA is spying on the American people, and I want to raise that issue through proper channels so that we can, you know, deliver all this information to the American public. Can we do that through official channels now? I don't think that would have been very well received by Mr. Snowden's superiors at Booz Allen.
Yeah. Have you formed any kind of working theory of Snowden's motivation? I mean, just in seeing, you know, he's on video, and apparently there will be a documentary.
Yeah, there's a woman I know named Laura Poitras, who's quite a talented documentary filmmaker.
And in fact, she's the one that he first approached, and she led to Glenn Greenwald at The Guardian and Bart Gellman at The Washington Post, it turns out.
That's right, and there's another interesting parallel, too, because I think, by all accounts, there's an interview with Laura in Salon. By all accounts, she felt it was very important to have a link to a mainstream media outlet and one that was connected to the power structure in Washington, D.C., i.e. The Washington Post. And so that was very much akin to the kind of calculation that was done at WikiLeaks initially, you know, getting a certain kind of, not exactly political immunity, but political cover from working with a mainstream media organization.
Mm-hmm. So I assume you've watched some of the video of Snowden. I mean, do you have a working, any initial thoughts about the nature of his motivation, or do you share any of Jeffrey Toobin's take on him as grandiose or any of that?
All of us are self-interested. I think he had a sense of a personal mission, but I don't think, I mean, Jeffrey Toobin wants to discount it and say, oh, he's just in it for himself. We're all in it for ourselves, as you know better than anybody, having written The Moral Animal.
Well, I mean, but not Jeffrey Toobin, right? I mean, it's just so happens that he wound up pursuing a career path that has him plastered all over CNN and The New Yorker, right? I mean,
Jeffrey Toobin would never try to promote himself. Absolutely not. Jeffrey Toobin is pure in every sense of the word. He would never try to advance his own personal agenda. He's only about the issues. Come on. So I think, you know, Jeffrey Toobin is trying to pull him down a notch and say, you know, this guy's just another reckless narcissist. No, I think we have to listen to what Snowden is saying. I think Snowden was deeply upset. I think he has a native distrust of the man, but also the kind of massive surveillance state that the NSA represents. And I think he saw over time, particularly, and he says, you know, he had high hopes for the Obama administration in terms of dialing back some of these excesses. They weren't dialed back. They were probably increased. So I think his motivations appear, at least at the moment, to be absolutely pure. So, you know, is that mixed with a certain amount of self-interest and wanting to take the stage for a moment? Sure. But what's wrong with that? I mean...
Yeah. And I mean, you know, I thought I saw in the video a little bit of, you know, maybe a tendency towards self-dramatization. We all have some of that. If he has more than the average person, I mean, what do you expect? It's not going to be the typical person who puts himself at risk to do this thing that you can certainly argue is a very important thing to do.
Absolutely. And he is an extraordinary person. And so we should expect him to behave in a way that's out of the realm of the normal. Now, you know, going back to the question you asked earlier, I mean, I had received a certain amount of criticism on the left for, in their view, pathologizing the whistleblower, you know, intimating that whistleblowers are alienated people. Now, I didn't make any kind of generalized statement about that. If I did, you know, I shouldn't have. But certainly I didn't make a statement like that in the film. The point is that it shouldn't be surprising that whistleblowers aren't rank-and-file conformists. You know, they're people who think out of the box and want to make a difference. In Manning's case, he wanted to make a difference not only politically, he wanted to make a difference in his own sexuality. But, I mean, it shouldn't be a surprise that people who do this kind of thing think outside the box. That should be, I think that's pretty uncontroversial, really.
Mm-hmm. Now, on the issue of some of the heat you've taken for your depiction of Julian Assange, I mean, after watching the film, I mean, I don't know what you left on the cutting room floor, but the sense, it certainly seems to be the case that people who were involved with Assange at like the highest, you know, his collaborators at WikiLeaks, some of his principal collaborators, seem to be quite disillusioned and unhappy with, among other things, the way he wound up conflating the cause with his, you know, his personal, what they saw as his personal issues in Sweden, right? I mean, am I?
Yeah, no, you read it exactly right. I mean, the people who were inside the organization were the ones who were most upset with what they saw as his betrayal of principles. And James Ball, who now is reporting on the Snowden issue for The Guardian, you know, was the de facto spokesperson for WikiLeaks for a while Julian Assange was in hiding. You know, he said it began to resemble a cult. I mean, they were trying to batter him into signing this NDA, a fully inclusive NDA that had to do with everything that would have made what he had already said about the organization in violation of the NDA he was supposed to sign. And for 2 days, there was a kind of psychological pressure campaign where they relentlessly hammered at him, you've got to do this for the good of the cause and so forth and so on. He said he found it like a cult. So this is somebody who was inside the organization who believed firmly in its principles. So yeah, you know, the Julian, of course, anybody who criticizes him is sleazy, you know, a jerk, you know, not to be trusted, you know, he demonizes them. But I think that, yeah, in the film, what you see are people inside the organization, speaking out about how they felt he had transgressed, you know, and I find it a little bit sad. For example, there's a woman in Iceland named Birgitta Jonsdottir who's very, you know, an Icelandic parliamentarian, who a poet turned parliamentarian. She was very much a part of the WikiLeaks effort to publish the video of the attack, the Apache gunship attack on some people in Iraq, in which two Reuters journalists were killed. You know, she was also one of those people who said to him, Julian, go take care of your issues in Sweden. Mm-hmm. And ultimately fell out with Julian. And, you know, in this is not in the film, but, you know, we kept contacting Julian and asking him about some of his, you know, ex-collaborators, and notably Birgitte Jonsdottir, whom he then referred to as a parasite because she was trying to suck off his fame.
Mm-hmm.
Well, talk about a narcissist. Anyway,
The
point is that there were a lot of people inside the organization or working with the organization who really were supporters of WikiLeaks. In fact, the women in Sweden were supporters of the idea of WikiLeaks. They they were very much a part of Julian's larger agenda. So, you know, but every time somebody raises an issue with Julian, they're a traitor, CIA dupe, whatever. I mean, it's kind of pathetic.
I will say that the opponents of WikiLeaks and the WikiLeaks mission, of course, were going to, in any event, seize on Assange's indiscretions, alleged indiscretions, to tar WikiLeaks, you know, whether or not Assange tried to kind of connect the two, right? Whether or not he made the argument that it was all a conspiracy, it was a honey trap, or whatever he would like to imply that it was, you know. The alleged indiscretions were going to be used to tar WikiLeaks, and so for defenders of WikiLeaks, you know, the two become inseparable rhetorically in a certain sense. And I think that's one reason they see you, some of them, as the enemy, because you played the indiscretions as you saw them. And as a practical rhetorical matter, the way these things play out, what tars Assange does wind up working against WikiLeaks, right? I mean,
it does to some extent, but I think it's also, frankly, what made Julian Assange as famous as he is today. You know, that's the peculiar thing in terms of the 24/7 news cycle, always hungry for a scandal. The sex scandal, I mean, rocketed him to fame in a way that I think the political stuff never would. I mean, that's one of the ironies of the story, it seems to me. But yeah,
right.
Of course, it had a complicating effect in that it also tarred him. But I think it raises another interesting issue, which is, you know, for a lot of people, Julian Assange was sticking it to the man, and he was properly holding the American national security state to account. And because there was such animus toward him from that quarter, from the American national security state, therefore all those who are opposed to the American state must line up slavishly with Julian Assange and exempt him from any criticisms. And he now has to be seen as perfect because, after all, if the American state is against you, you must be good. And that's where we get into that territory of what James Ball in the film calls noble cause corruption. You know, where Julian believes that his cause is so good and so pure that therefore he's entitled to do things that he would normally despise in others.
Okay.
Does that make any sense?
Yes. Have you heard from people who are in the film since the film came out?
Yeah, I have. You know, obviously James Ball, I've heard from Bill Leonard, who is the former classification czar under the Bush administration, who's really an intriguing voice in the film, I think, you know, arguing that we have way too many secrets and it's devastating our democracy, and a number of other people. And also, you know, there was obviously one of the interesting figures in this whole process has been Jemima Khan, who was one of Julian's initial she put up some of the money for his bail, who is an executive producer on the film and has since come out and written a big piece in the New Statesman about her disillusionment with Julian. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the other thing I think that should be said in terms of the film, for about two-thirds of the movie, Julian comes off pretty well. And I think his mission actually looks pretty good. You know, Julian likes to say that it's an anti-WikiLeaks film. It's certainly not. It's not opposed to the principles of WikiLeaks at all. In fact, I would go so far as to say it pretty much endorses them. But it does hold Julian to account. And Julian, as we know from his experiences with Australian Federal Police way back in the day, doesn't ever like to be held to account. That's just, it's in his DNA. I suppose none of us really like to be held to account, but Julian's
I'd just as soon avoid it myself, if it could be arranged, yeah. Anything else you want to say about the film or the making of it? It's really a, like I said, it's kind of on the one hand almost sprawling in the number of things, characters, pieces of geography it encompasses, but it winds up being this very coherent narrative, and you have a lot of good footage, even though Julian himself was, I guess, asking you for $1 million in exchange for interviewing him, and you took a pass on that. But it turns out there was a lot of good footage of Assange pretty much all along the way, not all of which had been public, right?
No, that's right. I was fortunate in being able to license footage from a very talented Australian filmmaker named Mark Davis. And Mark Davis had footage of Julian Assange at a moment that was never going to come again. Even if I interviewed him, I don't think Julian would have been able to take us back to the person that he was prior to his enormous fame. And so Mark was following Julian around with his camera just prior to and during the Afghan War Log publication. You can see a very different Julian Assange. I mean, obviously, you can see aspects of his later problems. So there's a certain kind of narcissism as he's in the makeup chair and so forth and so on. But there's also a kind of fierce idealism of this, this guy with his life in his laptop, kind of moving around the world, trying to hold governments and corporations to account. He's a sort of dashing romantic figure. And so it's fantastic to have that footage, because then you really feel the heat of what it must have been like at that moment in time. So I think that's that footage turned out to be absolutely critical.
Now you see the charisma. You see the charisma.
Absolutely. He's a very charismatic guy, and there's a reason. His downfall was actually a huge benefit to the organization initially, because one of his colleagues, Daniel Domscheit-Berg, who's now been vilified by Julian and others. Daniel was not a charismatic guy, and he never would have attracted the kind of attention that Julian did to the website and the cause. So there was a certain virtue in his character, the silver surfer of the internet, always with a different hairdo, but with a kind of a striking, charisma. And that, I think, was important for a long time. But it also got him into a lot of trouble. That's the other thing about the story. I mean, the story is rich with political intrigue and important thematic ideas, but it's also about some wild human characters. I mean, I think for those who seem to want to take the humanity out of the story, I never understand that motivation. Like, we're all supposed to be abstract political actors. It seems to me that embracing people's humanity is a pretty good thing, but maybe I'm naive.
Well, not to mention the fact that if you leave that part out, no one's going to watch your documentary. Seriously, it's like, when I tweeted something about your film, and somebody tweeted back, somebody who was no doubt offended by your treatment of Assange, tweeted back, oh, it bordered on the tabloidy. And I was like, I mean, you left in the human elements that any journalistic storyteller would have left in. I mean,
of course.
Frankly,
there was a lot of tabloidy material that is on the cutting room floor, which would have been purely for prurient interest. But I put in stuff that I think is compelling from a human perspective. We all like stories about people because we're people. We're interested in each other. And I don't see the need to make any apology for that whatsoever.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I recommend that people see it. If they're in certain cities, they can see it in a theater. If not, you can download it from iTunes for a reasonable price, I found. Really, really enjoyed it, and so did my wife.
Excellent. Glad to hear it. Thanks, Bob.
So thank you, Alex. I'll let you get back to making your next great film.
Thanks again, Bob. Good to talk.
Okay. See you around.